I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
Before we jump into this program, let me remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back to you. More information, www.mecu.com. Well, we're going to wrestle with the issue of institutional racism today. As I said at the top of the hour, it's a word that's thrown around a lot by many people. Some people don't think it exists. Some people do think it exists. It's a word that is talked about when we can't kind of put our hands around why racist acts take place. It came up during the conversations that we had here a couple of weeks ago with both Commissioner Batts, our new police commissioner in Baltimore City, who is African-American. Only significant in the context of what I'm about to say, and the state's attorney, Greg Bernstein, who is white, only important in the context of what I'm about to say, when we were wrestling with why there is so much brutality against African-American citizens by many police, why more African-Americans are arrested for the same crimes as white Americans commit and do time for the same crimes that white Americans do not do time for. And we started to wrestle with the question of institutional racism. Neither of my guests could really wrestle with what that meant. And in preparation for the show, one of the conversations that one of my producers had was with Dr. Raymond Winbush, a frequent guest on the show, the head of Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University. And Ray Winbush said to him, you know, it's a difficult show to do because he thinks it needs to be done. But he said most people can't define it. Some people can't even agree that it exists. And we have to talk, what does it mean? What do we mean when we talk about institutional racism? Is it Citizens United or institutional human beings with feelings and ideas? And that's what it means? Well, we're going to wrestle with what that means today and where it comes from. We are joined here in studio by Adar Ayira. A. Adar Ayira is project manager of the More in the Middle initiative at Associated Black Charities. She's also facilitator analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action. And good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let me get that mic in front of you.
Thank you for inviting me.
My apologies. We're also here. Michael Higginbotham is with us. Michael Higginbotham is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of the upcoming book, Ghosts of Jim Crow. And there's a link to check out his book on our website, steinershow.org, where you can find out a great deal more about that. And Michael Higginbotham, great to have you back in the studio. It's been a while.
Good to be back.
Doug Colbert's with us. He's professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Good to have you on here as well, Doug. Welcome back.
Nice to be here, Mark.
And joining us by phone is Megan Lamala Ortiz, who is a freelance media maker and publisher of La Mama Lita Mama, Mala.com and BabyLatino.com. And Megan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And all of you are with us here at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us. Did I say that right? Yes, I did. Who knows my generation? At Mark Steiner. Or jump onto Facebook and join us there as well, and we'll get your questions on the air. I'll be looking at Facebook in just a moment. 410-319-8888. Of course, my younger producers and engineers are all laughing at me now because of my tweeting mistakes. But anyway, here we go. So good to have you all with us. Let me just start with, you know, this is a question. This is something that people, I think, we use the word, the phrase all the time, institutional racism. And people have a million different definitions of what that means, but hard to put our hands around what to do about it and where it comes from. And let me just start. We had a conversation by phone, Doug and I did, the other week when I was talking about this program with him, and we started talking about the 13th Amendment. So let me just start there, and let's move our way back and forward to that. And Doug and Michael, please give us your sense of what is this 13th Amendment? What does it have to do with what we call institutional racism?
Well, you know, it begins, Mark, from the idea that I come at this from the perspective of law and how the Constitution has failed, miserably failed, to protect the rights of African-American people, Latino people, and other people of color. And so when I begin this discussion, I begin by saying that we're not talking here about individual prejudice. People can have their own attitudes, beliefs about other people. Often those are stereotypes and they're based on limited information. I do come at institutionalized racism from the notion that what we're talking about are people who have the power to discriminate against other people. So you may have individuals who are going to be able to deny people's access to equality, employment, and in the area of criminal justice, certain fundamental rights. But it also includes government or social, economic, political institutions that reinforce this notion of inferiority. So when we have that combination of both individual and institutionalized power, then we can look at the criminal justice system. And the short of it is that the 13th Amendment is a potential vehicle for telling a story that's rarely told in our law classes, in our schools. And it's a story that really gets to the heart of why there has been justification to deny people of color certain fundamental rights. You can look at the justice system. A very good case could be made that the justice system is a racist system. You need only look at the people who have been executed, who have received the death penalty. You can look at the people who have been excluded from juries, and it's been predominantly an all-white jury when you have a black-on-white crime or a white-on-black crime. You can look at juvenile justice and see all the people that have been moved to the adult system and the disproportionate numbers of African-Americans and people of color. In my area, you look at the people who receive bail and who are still waiting in jail to see a lawyer, to get a lawyer to represent them so that they don't have to stay in jail on limited cases. The 13th Amendment story is one that people are far more educated now than they were a month or two ago because of how many people have seen the movie Lincoln. And so Lincoln tells the story of how Congress debated whether there ought to be an amendment that abolished slavery. And even when you have the president, even when you have leading members of Congress, it failed the first time. It passed the second time really because of a lot of arm twisting by a very narrow margin. And what the 13th Amendment does is it looks at the badges and incidents of slavery. It looks at the underpinning of slavery, of what maintained the presumed inferiority of African-American people that would allow them, that would justify the institution of slavery. So the 13th Amendment is a historical argument. You look at slavery, you look at racial apartheid that followed Reconstruction, and you come all the way up to the 1960s. So you have 275 years in which, for the most part, people of color were denied certain fundamental rights of due process, certain rights that white people had.
Michael?
Well, it's so important what Doug said. The key aspect is people need to be clear what the definitions that they're dealing with are. Institutional racism, in my judgment, is simply when you have laws, practices, and policies that that discriminate, that result in inequality, racial inequality in our institutions, in our organizations, in our entities. It's so important to define what you're talking about when you talk about racism, because there's also cultural racism. And institutional racism basically reinforces cultural racism, which is something that Doug was talking about, individual racism, personal racism, where individuals basically have values or notions or ideas or thoughts that embrace a racial hierarchy. So when Doug talks about the 13th Amendment and identify slavery as an institution that basically was involved racism, institutional racism, by having slavery, which basically enslaved blacks and only blacks, you also then have, even though the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, you have ideas and notions in individual Americans that embrace that racial hierarchy of slavery, of whites being on top, of blacks being on the bottom. And so it's really important to make sure you're identifying the type of racism that's involved, whether it's institutional or cultural, because the end result is you want to eliminate the inequality. And if you don't identify what your goal is, then you're going to miss the boat and you're not going to be able to make a difference in terms of racial equality.
I think one of the things that, and I will come back to history and come back to the present as well here, and Adara, I welcome to the program.
Thank
First
you.
Time on the air with us. It's good to have you here. When we have a difficulty figuring out what this thing means, institutional racism, because it's one of these words that kind of pop out in conversation, either accusatorily or dismissively, any other way it might pop out in conversation. And as a non-lawyer, as a social activist non-lawyer, I mean, how do you see it defined? I mean, in other words, I mean, how would it exist? How does it exist and how would it exist? Whether it's an institution like Morgan State University, could it exist here in a historically black college, in a university in this country? Does it exist in the police department? Does it exist in the school system?
Well, let me back up before we even get to institutional racism, because institutional racism is a tool. It is a tool to legally manifest or to culturally manifest structural racism. And structural racism has an array of dynamics, which you just defined. It is the interpersonal. It is the institutional. It is the cultural. It is an array of dynamics which normalizes and legitimizes the discrimination that occurs within institutions and within society. It normalizes and legitimizes the racial bias. So when we talk about structural racism, when we talk about institutional racism, what we're talking about is a power dynamic. And so we can look at Morgan State University. We can look at Coppin. We can look at Sojourner Douglas College. We can look at Black History Month. And we can say, well, wait a minute. Why do they have their own institutions? And part of the power dynamic and the invisibility and the normalization of structural racism allows society to say that without looking at the parallel view, which is that 12 months out of the year is the time that history, American history, and what is identified as American history, which does not necessarily include the history of anybody who is not white, that's when that is taught. We can ignore the fact that institutions that are historically black or predominantly black were created because those white identified institutions did not allow African Americans or other people of color entry into the institutions. So when we talk about this, we have to do it with our eyes on the power differential.
So does it mean – so one thing you alluded to here, and I know, look, Megan, please jump in since we can't see you, but I know you're there.
Yes,
are we talking about – what you said, Adara, a moment ago, alluded to something conscious. You know, is it something conscious?
No.
Is it something embedded? I mean, you know, it's like when people try to identify what a black hole is, and the debates over a black hole in the universe, we have a very difficult time identifying what this gravitational madness is going in the universe. So the question is, so what is, how do we define it then, for people trying to put their hands around what this means? Megan, go ahead, since we haven't heard from you, then we'll jump into everybody else.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think that's part of the debate as to what institutional racism is. You know, habit versus intent. And I think, you know, specifically in the context of the United States, you know, post-13th Amendment and going now, you know, we need to look at, you know, the pattern and practices of what defines, quote-unquote, America. And what all the other guests were talking about, you know, really point to the normalization of whiteness, right, to the, obviously, the creation of this hierarchy of everything else. And I think, you know, something that complicates the issue is, you know, the issue of intersectionality and how people try to sort of lessen the impact of the intent, because I think there definitely is an issue of intent in institutional racism, in structural racism, in keeping a certain group of people out. And I think one of the ways that people try to keep that out or try to make it seem less intentional. It's like, well, you know, we have to, it's class, it's not, it's race, it's gender, it's not race. And failing to look at how all these other issues really work together against people of color. You know, and I think specifically, you know, we can look at the case of Latinos as an example. You know, Latino identity is not a racial identity. And I think it's very complicated for people to understand a lot of times. But it's a group of different nationalities, a group of different ethnicities. But what we have in the United States, because of the context and legacy of slavery, we have the racialization of ethnicities and nationalities. So I think, you know, as a Latina and as a Puerto Rican who identifies as multiracial, it's very complicated to look at the issue of intent versus habit, and just in like the larger global context of what this means as we deal with immigrants, especially coming into the United States.
So everybody wants to give me something here.
Everybody wants a piece of this. I think that it is embedded. It was embedded and codified by laws, which Doug can talk about more. I think that it is habit. It is cultural. It is implicit. Our bias is implicit, and it is unconscious. For example, we may believe that we are progressive, that we are anti-racist, that we are liberal, but when it comes down to how we unconsciously or implicitly act, we can show our bias. And we also have to look at, as we're looking at intersectionality, we have to look at white skin privilege and the role that white skin privilege plays in society. Because we can have immigrants come in. If immigrants come in and as the immigrants make the journey to assimilation in America, for ethnic whites, a very important piece of that journey historically has been to identify with whiteness. And a huge part of whiteness was accepting the racial strata of society, which put whites on top and African Americans on the bottom. So your level of assimilation in large measure depends on whether you have or acquire white skin privilege in society. If you do, then there's a way in which you can assimilate more, be accepted more, be seen as a little bit less of the other. Now, of course, this is mitigated by class. It's mitigated by national origin. It is mitigated by whether you speak English or not. But it is still there.
I don't think intent is at all significant today. As I mentioned in my book, Ghosts of Jim Crow, I think what's important is the impact, the effect. Laws prior to the Civil War intentionally discriminated on the basis of race. But once those laws were eliminated, then you had Jim Crow. Jim Crow did the same thing. Once Jim Crow was eliminated, that still didn't necessarily change how people think. It didn't change notions of racial superiority that were embedded by the institutional racism of slavery and Jim Crow segregation. So one of the problems that we need to, of course, deal with is changing hearts and minds of individuals today, whether they are black, white, Latino, American Indian, Asian American. We've all been impacted. We've all been influenced by these laws, by these practices. Mm-hmm. And we've got to do something about the mindset, how people still think today, consciously or unconsciously.
And that unconscious, Mark, is really the fact that we need to look at our decision makers, and decision makers need to examine their decisions. Because so much of racism today, I believe, is not the overt type of the bigot. We still have bigots. We still have people who are going to be focusing on racial violence. But people, for the most part, know what to say and what not to say. You're not going to find that smoking gun, that memorandum that says we fired these folks because they're black. Proving intent is one of the greatest hurdles. That's why the 14th Amendment Equal Protection doesn't work anymore. When you look at unconscious behavior, there's two things here. One is individuals, whether it's police or judges or prosecutors or lawyers, they need to look at their decisions, or teachers, to see whether or not we're favoring unconsciously our white students as opposed to our students of color or our students who come from a different national origin. And at the same time, the 13th Amendment eliminates, you don't have to show intent. Intent's not part of it. What 13th Amendment, the value of it is you make a historical connection to the past and you link it to a present form of race discrimination. So you don't look at death penalty and say, did the prosecutor discriminate against the person on death row, or did the legislature pass these laws to kill black people? That's not the question. It's to look at the continuum that began from the time the first African Americans came to this country, and to look at other people of color and to see how those rights have continued to be denied, whether it be the right of life, the right of liberty, the right of property, the right of happiness. It's all of those rights, and it's a most powerful vehicle for educating this generation of student, not just law student. This should be taught in high school.
What should be taught in high school?
The 13th Amendment and how...
And its effect on...
The remaining, the legacy, the badges of innocence that we see today.
So we have to take a break, quick break here. But what I want to come back to, and Lawrence, you're our first caller, we're going to come to your call. But if when we're defining institutional racism, and you see people of color as police officers, people of color as police commissioners, people of color as judges, who institute the practices that make our prisons, not just solely, obviously, but part of a system, that institute the practices that make the majority of the people in our prison system people of color. What does it say about how we define institutional racism and how we address it? How do you change it in this larger sense? We'll come right back to all that. Don't go away. As we wrestle with institutional racism with four really interesting guests and you at 410-319-8888.
Beast by Supremo for all of my people, Negroes and Latinos, and even the gringos. Yo, check it, one for Charlie Hustle, two for Steady Rock, three for the fourth coming live, future shot. It's five dimensions, six senses, seven firmaments of heaven to hell, 8 million stories to tell, nine planets faithfully keep in orbit with the probable tenth. The universe expands length, the body of my text possess extra strength, power lifted powerless, up out of this towering inferno, my ink so hot it burned through the journal, I'm blacker than midnight on Broadway and Myrtle, hip hop past all your tall social hurdles, like the nationwide projects, prison industry complex, working class poor, better keep your alarm set, streets too loud to ever hear freedom ring, say it back in with your sleep, it's dangerous to dream, but your chain cats get they chip, you dead now, killing fields need blood to graze the cash cow, it's a numbers game, but don't add up somehow, like I got 16 to 32 bars to rock it, but only 15% of profits, ever seen my pockets like 69 billion in the last 20 years, spent on national defense, but folks still live in fear, like nearly half of America's largest cities is one quarter black, that's why they gave Ricky Ross all the crap, 16 ounces to a 20 more to a key, a 5 minute sentence hearing and you're no longer free. 40% of Americans own a cell phone so they can hear everything that you say when you ain't home. I guess Michael Jackson was right, you are not alone. Rock your hard hat black as you in the terror dome. Full of hearts, making large, making dice tumblers. Young teens in prison greens facing life numbers. Crack mothers, crack babies, and AIDS patients. Young bloods can't spell, but they can rock you a PlayStation. This new map is up for a new ass. You want to know how to rhyme, you better learn how to add. It's
Mighty most death.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out.
This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment.
Yeah. We sell crack to our own out the back of our homes. You smell the musk of the dusk and the crack of the dawn. We go through episodes too, like Attack of the Clones. What till we break a bag and you hear the crack of the bone? To get by, just to get by, just to get by.
I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are talking here about institutional racism this hour on The Mark Steiner Show. Just saying, it could have been 2 hours. It will be next time. We are here with Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland, Carey School of Law, Michael Higginbotham, the William Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of the upcoming book, Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. A. Adara Ayira is with us. She's project manager of the More in the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action. Megan Lamala Ortiz joins us by phone, freelance media maker. See if I have this right, if it's written right, my thing. LamitaMala.com and BibiaLatino.com are her sites. 410-319-8888 is number here. We have a lot of callers, so let me jump into this first and answer the question first that I wrestled with before we went to break about the fact that now we have a post-segregated society, post-legal segregated society, where there are many African Americans in power in different institutions, but we are continuing with the practice of putting people of color in prisons. How does institutional racism define that, and how is it underpinning to what we're seeing? Who wants to go first? Michael?
I think the short answer is it doesn't really matter what color a person is. It's the values that they bring to the job. So if you have slavery and you have an overseer that's black, he's still whipping the slave. So it really doesn't matter, I think, what color the person is. If you have an institution that results in a disproportionate impact based on race. In other words, like the death penalty that Doug mentioned earlier, four times as likely to get the death penalty today in Georgia and many other states if you're black and your victim is white than if you're white and your victim is black. So if you have an institution, if you have a practice that's going on like the death penalty where you have this disproportionate impact, something is wrong. And the Supreme Court had a big case, McCleskey versus Kemp, 1987, where you had four Supreme Court justices, including Thurgood Marshall, who said, when you have these kinds of disparities, 4-1, there's something really wrong, and we need to find out what that is. The four justices in dissent said, we're not concerned about intent. We don't need to prove whether the system intentionally is killing blacks. If you have a 4-1 ratio, there's something wrong, and we need to prevent that. So a quick solution would be to reduce and eliminate laws and practices that have this disproportionate impact. When you see that, something is wrong, and it needs to be investigated and prevented. Racial profiling is another example. What difference does it make if the police are black, if they have a racial profile that basically says we're going to stop blacks on the highway on 95 going north? So to me, race is not as significant as the values that are being brought to the job.
I agree with Michael. We are dealing with institutions, and it would be good to remember that structural racism or institutional racism really isn't just an American issue. We find this anywhere in the globe where countries have been colonized. There are people who are considered less than and people who are throwaway people. We should all be using a tool. It's a practical application of a racial equity lens. And in essence, that's what Michael is talking about, practical application of a racial equity lens. So if we see that there are disparities, racial disparities, we need to stop questioning it. We need to stop doubting it. We need to start dealing with it.
Yeah, I would only say, Mark, that no one is immune from this, that everyone must examine their practices. We're not just talking criminal justice, by the way. It's education, it's employment,
absolutely.
It's housing.
Right.
It's all the decisions that we make.
So let me get Megan, why don't you jump in and go to the phones.
I do want to say something briefly about that. I think part of the confusion is that people assume that in this quote-unquote post-racial era, right, or even, you know, if you want to talk about post-13th Amendment, we assume that somebody's presence, a person of color's presence, African-American, Latino, equals representation, that we can change sort of these systems from within. And I think that that's a real concern, and we even saw it in the debate, you know, over who's going to be on President Obama's cabinet the second term. And I think we need to be really cautious in thinking that we can change huge systems by having people who may or not be placed there as tokens. That really doesn't change any of the practices of these systems, whether we are talking about, you know, policing systems, incarceration systems, educational systems, and health systems.
People take an oath to uphold those systems.
sometimes the response to what you see, if you're within that system, is limited by the system itself, which to me is part of the definition of institutional racism. If you're a Baltimore City police officer or anybody, a Baltimore County police officer, and what's identified as the enemy, what's identified as potential trouble, what's identified as potential criminal, is a young black man walking down the street. I mean, that's embedded in the system.
But we need to collect data, Mark, and that's where the decision makers are pushing back against just the notion of get the statistics, find out who the police are arresting, who's in jail, who's getting the jobs, who's getting the good grades. I mean, whatever the issue is, just check it against data so that if you don't think that you have any racism, prejudice of any kind, mark it up against the decisions that you're making to see whether or not there's something unconscious there. We all have that duty.
410-319-8888. Romney, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I was really enjoying the show, and I really wanted to ask any of the
and ladies as well. But go ahead. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Go ahead, Romney. I'm sorry.
Hey, I just wanted to ask the panel, had they ever come across a book called The Great Conspiracy by John A. Logan? It was printed in 1886. Logan was one of Lincoln's top generals, but he was also later a senator. And he dedicated this book to all the young men of America. And there were some very interesting things in the book. And I was wondering, and especially relative to the proposed 13th Amendment, and the discussions that they had in the general, in the Senate, relative to the amending the Constitution.
I just looked up the book, and now I'm going to get the book and read it, and we'll come back and talk about it.
I'm not familiar with the book, but I think the period, the Reconstruction period, is just a fascinating one. I'm sure it deals with that aspect, and for me, it's such a disappointment to look at what's going on today with the tremendous racial disparities that continue to exist when, if you look at Reconstruction, we made tremendous strides during Reconstruction in terms of elected officials, black elected officials, in terms of creation of jobs for blacks. We did tremendous job in terms of eliminating some of the racial violence. We did a tremendous job at a certain point during Reconstruction, and then it ended. It stopped. And we adopted Jim Crow segregation and eliminated black voting rights and many other things. So for me, it's fascinating to look at Reconstruction because it gives us an example of the fact that it can be done. If we have a commitment, if we make some significant changes, it can be done.
We also removed the troops. And once the troops left, people no longer had any protection of their rights. So one of the things we're looking at with the 13th Amendment, Mark, is the guarantee was not only the guarantee of eliminating slavery, it was the guarantee of freedom. That's what the right is in the 13th Amendment. And the Supreme Court says as much. In 1883, I think what the gentleman was referring to, the civil rights cases, the Supreme Court unanimously said that the 13th Amendment guaranteed universal civil and political freedom. And the question is, what does freedom mean? If it means one thing, said Justice Harlan, it means freedom from discrimination. And that took 85 years until 1968 for the Supreme Court in a housing discrimination case out of St. Louis to finally said that if it means anything, it means the right to live where you want, to buy the home that you can afford. That's how long it's taken. Now, for some reason, and maybe Michael or maybe the other guests have some idea, educators have not picked up on this whole notion of freedom rights.
So before we jump into that, let me get a caller here to ask a similar question, then we'll jump to our other two guests as well. 410-319-8888. Diane and Laurel, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, welcome.
Great conversation amongst intellectuals, and you're hitting on some very good points. But I have to ask the question, because I've thought it often myself over the years, how many generations is it going to take for this stuff to finally be weeded out and we've made it to that threshold, so to speak, do you think?
What is the solution? I figured you were. I saw what you were going to go there. I wanted to get this out there. Let me let you go first and bring Megan in. I mean, this is the what do we do question.
Mm-hmm. You know, as much as we talk about the system and the institutions, there is responsibility that we bear too. We citizens. A lot of times we believe that we are powerless, and we are never powerless. We're not powerless victims. We are people with a history of organizing, of mobilizing. We have to deal with our internalized depression and our apathy, too. And I say this in reference to organizations. And, of course, my mind automatically goes to Associated Black Charities, because that is one of the organizations with whom I work. We know that historically we have not really given support to organizations who are working on behalf of this equity agenda. If we give our financial support, if we give our mobilizing support, if we turn out, then we can create a will. That's what President Obama did in his first and second campaigns. It's just that after the campaign is over, we think, oh, okay, our job is done, when really our job is beginning. Power concedes nothing without a demand. We stop demanding when the campaign is over. And we have got to mobilize around those organizations that are still working to create that demand. That's what we need to do, and that's what will help change the dynamics.
Megan?
I think something that, moving away from the organizational model, and I think, you know, organizations have historically done great work, but I think also we need to, you know, be aware of, you know, what the nonprofit industrial complex looks like, and how institutional racism works there in terms of funding, et cetera. But I think in terms of our communities, there are great opportunities for individuals and communities to step up to create alternative models, to create models of what they want, their communities and their governments to look like. So whether this means, you know, whether we're talking about policing, creating sort of examples of cop watches, examples of community watches, so that we also move away from this idea of dependence on these systems that really are failing to serve our communities and are really harming us more than anything. And I think, you know, in terms of education, the same sort of thing. You know, we need to really step up a little bit more. And support, you know, our public schools, making sure that they don't get shut down. So I think we need to, you know, have conversations among ourselves, in our families, and in our communities, and work on creating alternative models.
And I'm sorry, and I just need to push back on that a little bit. I understand about the nonprofit industrial model, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about organizations which the community own. And if we give up our ownership of those organizations, then we do leave them to funding from outside sources. We own those organizations, and we have to pick up that ownership and make it be what we need it to be to move our communities and families forward.
I think the point here is that there's a lot that we can do, and the more that we talk about it, it hopefully is going to lead to action. We may sound like intellectuals, but every person here, I guess, is a real activist. And what we need to do is more activism. We need to bring these discussions to our students, to our neighbors, to our communities. You know, if we're talking Frederick Douglass, one of the great quotes that I always like to cite is right after the 13th Amendment passed, Frederick Douglass said, "Verily, the work does not end with the abolition of slavery, but only begins." And Michael was talking about Reconstruction. We got maybe another 7 or 8 years of Reconstruction before everything fell apart. And then it stayed apart until after Brown v. Board, when you had that movement. And that's when the baton keeps getting passed along. And there are a lot of ordinary people that can do this work.
And let me just pick up, and Michael, jump in here, but this is one of the things that I just pick up what Megan was saying, though. The other side of what Megan was saying was, if you look at how activist liberal organizations give money out, talk about institutional racism, mm-hmm. and bias, mm-hmm. and unconscious, I think, in some ways. I don't believe it's conscious. But you can name, in this community, this is the Baltimore community, I can name just one nonprofit with a budget of $1 million is as effective work that's given money. Mm-hmm. And that's Joe Jones's group. Mm-hmm. No other. Mm-hmm. Our Institute for Urban Families. Do great work. But nonprofits in Baltimore give money to white people mm-hmm. who work with black people.
Well, this is extremely important notion here, and we really want to focus on it because we need to do two things. And Adar talked about one, which is empowerment. We really have to empower the black community, other racial minority communities, politically, economically, socially. We've got to do that. We also need to value, of course, integration and diversity. We don't want to lose sight of that. But one of the things we didn't do in Brown is we desegregated, but we did not empower. We did not empower the black community. We did not empower other racial minorities. The second thing we need to do is we really need to be careful on some of the laws. We really need to change some of the laws that are having this negative impact. And I sense the caller's frustration. I really do. It's been a long road. You know, Dr. King talked about the arc of the moral line, and it bends toward justice. It's been a long road. I sense her frustration. I think Bessie Smith, the jazz singer in the 1920s, had it right. She said, it's been a long road, but it's got to have an end. So I picked up my bags and I tried it again. We need to try one more time and get it right, and we can do that.
But what does it mean? Now, then Diane and Woodlawn, we come to call and try, get Mike to these two calls in here. When you just use the word empower, communities of color, but what is, in the face of institutional racism, what exists in terms of how things are structured, what does that mean?
Well, for me specifically, in terms of political empowerment, I mean, we can value, we can recreate our political districts to increase minority representation. Instead, what we have done in many respects is to reduce it. And so one of the things, I mean, if you look at the Senate, we've got two blacks in the Senate.
Both
now.
Appointed.
Both appointed.
Both
exactly.
Appointed.
That's, exactly.
Both appointed.
Exactly.
And
so,
one's a former student of mine.
so we need to do some things in terms of redesigning our districts and our political representation so that it encourages racial diversity, so that it encourages gender diversity, not so that it reduces it.
See, and I also think that it's not just the laws. I actually think that the laws in many areas are really quite good. It's the practice. It's the fact that they're not being enforced. You know, you can look at the letter of the law. Everything looks fine in some areas, like anti-discrimination, et cetera. We're not being vigilant. We're not being present. We're not looking in on systems and seeing how the individuals are doing. In the criminal justice system, there's hardly any people from the community in those courts. And there's no one who's sort of questioning the decision makers. Why are bail bondsmen making a fortune off the backs of the poorest and the working people of this community? Why, if you talk about slavery, Mark, if you talk about 13th Amendment, we still put a price tag on people's liberty.
And we have a lot of callers, but Adar, I know you want to jump in on Megan's.
Yeah, and I would just – I would co-sign on what Megan was talking about in terms of alternative solutions, that it can't be – there is no one answer. There are many answers, and we all have a piece of this, a piece of the answer.
Mm-hmm. Let me – Megan, do you want to jump in before we get to the phones? We have like 8 minutes left in the segment. I want to get to some callers, but please go ahead.
Megan? I'm here. We need to, just expand our political imagination. I think we, you know, in terms of freedom and defining what empowerment means across communities of color, I think, you know, we tend to limit it, especially in the face of structural racism, to just look at, you know, legislative action, to just look at voting, instead of pushing back about what we can do, you know, in the in-between times, as has been said before, but also, you know, be proactive. I think we tend to be more reactive now, given the breadth and the legacy of institutional racism. And I think we need to start envisioning, well, what is it that we do on instead of waiting for something to happen to us?
And I think that, you know, and one thing maybe we can pick up on something that Michael said on another program, as soon as we look at this, and we talk about changing political districts, I was reading about Shirley Chisholm this morning when she ran her campaign Unbossed and Unbowed, Unbought, I should say, Unbossed and Unbought. Mm-hmm. And I reflect on a lot of people who were part of the Progressive Caucus and Congressional Black Caucus in Congress. And I'm not so sure I can say that, okay, we have a lot of new folks in Congress, but are they unbought? So what's another conversation, 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let us go to Diane and Woodlawn. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I think having these intentional conversations is one part of the solution. So I was wondering if the panel could speak intentionally about the role of white liberal bias in perpetuating structural racism.
That's a huge question and an appropriate one.
It's a very big problem, and it's one that I feel particularly because so many of my friends, they don't even call themselves progressives. They're liberals, and they think they are so pure and clean from and removed from this, but they're not doing anything. And I keep saying, why don't you leave your home? Why don't you call a meeting? Why don't you do something? And it's like this fear. And so the liberal community really needs to speak up and needs to be heard. That silence is deafening.
I would say that what I would hope for the white liberal community is that they really could look at themselves and recognize their blind spots. We all have them. And we hold on to our sense of ourselves as good people or good white liberal people. And that becomes the framework through which everything else is filtered, and that is a detriment to racial equity.
Let's try to get on the call in here, but then we'll go to our other guests here. Mike, you're on the air. Mike,
how you doing? I'm gonna be real quick.
Yeah, you don't have much time, but please do. Yeah.
Okay. Basically, and I was more interested in when you talk about institutionalized racism. I was more interested in knowing about the psyche of the European and why they did what they. Why do we have to prove to them that this needs to be done? You know, you enslaved us. You did this. Like, they don't know that that's wrong. Like, what is the psyche? I haven't read no books on it. I've always read books about what they did and what policies and procedures and things, the law they created after the fact,
right.
What they took. But I have never read a book on the psyche of the European and why he did what he did. And I don't want to hear it because it was for economic reasons. Can anybody answer that question for me?
Well, it's a huge question. I think we need to do an entire show on that. But if anybody wants to grab a minute of this, please do.
Well, I would say clearly there's notions of racial hierarchy. There's notions of all kinds of hierarchy. But I think when you look at the history of the United States, clearly there was an embrace of racial hierarchy. It was manifested in slavery and in Jim Crow practices. And it still exists today in terms of the disparities, in terms of a tipping point notion in housing where you have white flight that continues to go on. I mean, it's evident in a lot of things that go on today, and I think clearly that's part of the solution to eliminate those notions.
And I think that this is – Mike raised a really important question. I think it is something for an entire program in this whole series you want to create. But I'm going to go ahead, Adar.
Baltimore Racial Justice Action has a reading list that you can find on their website. Just Google the group. But one of the books is called Yerugu by Dr. Marimba Ani, and it speaks to that question.
And I think that the other part of it is that, you know, when you talk about the history of our country, that the racism we practice in the West today really did grow from the 1500s on. And it was slavery, and it was economics. It was slavery and rum and sugar and tobacco and the trade back and forth that created this kind of philosophy of racism that allowed this thing to flourish and to take root over the last 600 years on this planet. And I think that's something we do have to go back that far to wrestle with it. And I think that we don't do that enough.
And why are we so reluctant to look at history? Because it has the answers to so many of today's problems.
No, I agree, and I think there's a lot there. So that's what we're going to try to do here with this conversation we've been having is to, and I would say this could go 2 hours. We couldn't do it today because we had some other things already planned when I decided to do this. But that we are going to make this a constant part of a conversation here on the Mark Steiner Show. Maybe it'll be weekly. Maybe it'll be weekly 2-hour specials, 1-hour specials to wrestle with this, the history of it, where it comes from. There are people who are thinking and writing about the mass psychology. There are people thinking and writing about what these institutions mean, about how to change it, and what our history and how our history drove us to this point. Our earlier caller, Romani, called in. I have Googled that book. I just bought it on Amazon while we were talking about it, so I can read it and I consume and see what that book said. I think there's so much out there that we have to understand to be able to change this, and which I think we can do. So we have a minute left. We have to wrap now? You're saying no call? Wrap? Yes. Tell me what to do. You're the boss. Yes? Wrap? Call? Chris, a very quick thought. Chris, a very quick thought. We only have like a minute left.
Hello?
Chris?
Yes, I'm calling about military racism.
Okay, but I have like a minute, so I don't think we can wrestle with that whole thing right now, but go ahead.
Can you have a show on that one day?
Yes. And why don't you write me at Mark, M-A-R-C, at steinershow.org. Tell me your thought, and yes, we will bring that up.
Okay, I appreciate it.
No, I think it's real. Because we have this whole mythology of America that the military is what integrated America, but it's more complex than just that. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank all of our guests. This has been fascinating, but we've only kind of touched the surface. We'll come back to this. I think it's something that's going to help define it. We're starting a new series, by the way, which is on philosophy, but not just philosophy. Is why is world philosophy so Eurocentric? What about philosophers that aren't European? Why do we ignore that? How does that fill out our human species? So we're going to wrestle with all this stuff coming up in the coming weeks. And I want to thank our guests, Adara Ayero, who's with us, Project Manager for More in the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, Megan Lamala Ortiz, who La Mamarita Mala and Vivir Latino are her two sites, Michael Higginbotham, Wilson Elkins Professor of Law, stood on Mark, the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of the upcoming book, Ghost of Jim Crow. You can connect to the site about his book at steinershow.org. We have all the links there. Doug Colbert, who is Professor of Law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, who has been fighting for years here in Baltimore City to make sure that everyone has a lawyer at bail and continues to make that part of his struggle. Thank you all for being with us. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.